Earlier this week, military historian Sir Michael Howard had an op-ed piece in the New York Times that struck us. He's a professor of military and naval history at Yale. He taught at Oxford University for 20 years. His many books include Studies in War and Peace, War and the Liberal Conscience, and The Causes of War. His op-ed piece was about the much-quoted 1831 book On War by the Prussian officer Karl von Clausewitz. Howard translated the book into English. In the op-ed piece, he quoted Clausewitz as saying, "The fact that a bloody slaughter is a horrifying act must make us take war more seriously, but not provide an excuse for gradually blunting our swords in the name of humanity. Sooner or later, someone will come along with a sharp sword and hack off our arms." Howard thinks it's important to remind Americans that war, however horrible, is sometimes necessary.
If you decide that you're not going to go to war at all, ever, you do rather put yourself at the mercy of people who are prepared to go to war, who are prepared to inflict and suffer those losses. And so, if one is going ultimately either to defend oneself, or to defend one's values, or to defend one's friends, or to defend the resources necessary for one's survival, there has got to be at the bottom line a willingness, if necessary, to fight, and if necessary, to suffer. And by suffering, it does mean people getting killed. And so I'm afraid what Clausewitz then said applies as much now as it ever did.
I'm wondering what your response is now to the American peace movement. Do you think that the movement is informed at all by a response against war that is unrealistic?
Well, there are various elements in the peace movement. There is the absolute Christian pacifist tradition, which says that the use of force under any circumstances is immoral and contrary to the teaching of Christ. Therefore, whatever the temptations and whatever the difficulties, we will not fight. Well, that is an attitude which one cannot but respect, but it does really mean we're contracting out of international political life. The next element is that which says we can settle this without fighting. Why did we not stand back and allow sanctions to bite for longer? Why did we not simply confine ourselves to the protection of Saudi Arabia and let Kuwait go? Why is it necessary to invade Iraq at all? Well, all those seem to me to be perfectly understandable, legitimate, and defensible positions. The decision to go to war was taken prematurely. I myself don't believe that it was, but I have sympathy for those who do think so. But once it has been taken, you are then in a rather different ballgame. Because, as Clausewitz said, war is a contest of wills. And the more Hussein perceives that the American public are not united behind the war, the more he sees that there is a powerful element which wants to bring it to a halt, the more he is likely to feel that it is worth his while to go on stalling, to go on fighting, and to go on deterring us and frightening us. And therefore, the longer the war is likely to last. And that is why, although I have deep sympathy and I think understanding with the peace movement, I fear very much that their activities could be prolonging the war rather than bringing it to a halt.
So you think that the people's support is a very important part of any war campaign, and that opposition can really hurt the cause. Of course, one of the things that really complicates this in America is this kind of deep-seated suspicion of governmental motives. I mean, after deceit from Vietnam and Watergate and Iran-Contra, I think there are a lot of people who wonder, what is this war really about? What are the motives that America really has that they're perhaps not stating directly as their motives? So how do you, in your thought of the importance of public support, take into account this fear of being deceived and misled by the government who's waging the war?
I think it's understandable, and I think the track record of certain American governments has not been at all good. But I just remind your listeners, this is not just an American war. You will have a large number of allies and associates that you have got fighting beside you in the desert. You've got Saudi Arabians, and you have, if I may say so, British. and the British are as convinced about the necessity for this war as you are. If the American government has done a snow job, as it were, on their own people, they have not done it on us. They have not done it on the United Nations. They succeeded in getting a virtual unanimous vote from the United Nations, including a number of extremely suspicious and reluctant allies and others, to go along with the idea that this war is necessary. It is not a war just for American interests. It's a war for world interests, and world interests for two reasons. First, that we are trying to establish, slowly and not very successfully, a world order in which it will not be safe for large nations to attack and to digest and to destroy their small neighbors. Secondly, I know people say that this is a war only for oil, but only for oil. It's like saying it's a war only for air, only for oxygen. Oil is not simply a matter of the price of gas at the pumps, and it is not a matter simply of the profits of oil companies. It's a matter of the survival of the whole of the industrialized world. A threat that oil supplies are going to get into the hands of a dangerous, egocentric dictator is not a threat simply to the American government. It's a threat, really, to the stability of the economy of the world. So I think that although there is this tradition of suspicion of the American government on the part of the people, this is one occasion in which the American government really does have a completely clear conscience and clean hands.
You're the author of a book called War and the Liberal Conscience. I'll confess I haven't seen the book, but I was wondering if you could tell us what the central premise of the book is.
Well, it's a very good book, and I advise all of you to read it. It's published by Rutgers University Press. Go out and buy it at once. What it is about is the reaction of liberals, by which I mean people who believe in the perfectibility of man and who believe in self-government and who believe, ultimately, that all conflicts can be reconciled. How they react to war and how they have reacted over the past 200 years, and why it is that over and over again they have found it necessary or desirable to support wars.
Do you consider yourself fitting into that group that you describe as the liberal conscience?
Very, very much. And it has been a problem for me ever since I was a kid. This was really why I tackled that as a historian.
So you really were kind of instinctively opposed to war, but you found yourself getting behind certain wars?
Well, I was instinctively opposed to war. I was one of those generation which grew to maturity in the 1930s with the shadow of World War I heavily over me. And the idea of another war seemed absolutely crazy and inconceivable. But by the time I grew up in the later 30s, it was clear that there was a war which had to be fought. And I then came to the conclusion that there were wars which had to be fought. And then started worrying about why are the wars which have to be fought and what are the criteria by which we do judge them. So, this has, in a way, been the story of my life.
Now, you fought in World War II. You were in the British Army in the Italian campaign from 1943 to 45. You were wounded twice. I'm wondering how that experience on a personal level affected your view of war and your interest in becoming a military historian.
Well, it affected my view of war to the extent that if one's involved in an earthquake, one gets rather interested in earthquakes. And I suppose that the same way as some kid who's caught up in an earthquake might decide to become a seismologist, I decided to become a military historian. That affected my view of war to that extent. But it also affected my understanding of war, of what it involves and how it's fought. And I remember sitting after a particularly horrible battle outside Salerno, in which sort of dead and wounded were all around, and thinking, war is a realm of moral evil. Once you get involved in a war, you are involved in evil. You are committing it as well as suffering it. And therefore, anything which can be done to avoid getting involved in a war should be done, but nonetheless, ultimately, the bottom line is that you may have to.
My guest is Sir Michael Howard, a professor of military and naval history at Yale University. More with Howard in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Sir Michael Howard is my guest. He's a professor of military and naval history at Yale University. I'm wondering what your reaction is to the sudden visibility and popularity of military historians and retired generals on all the network TV and cable TV now and analyzing the war.
Well, obviously, it's a boost for retired generals and for military historians. As being one of that ilk myself, I can't really complain about it. All I would warn you is not to overestimate the contribution which we can make. I'm desperately sorry if there's unfortunate retired generals who have to appear every night on CBS or somewhere and give instant comments to the news, because poor things, they are actually probably as bewildered and uncertain about it as we are. But still, I suppose they get a fee.
Now, in spite of what you just said about the difficult spot that all the retired generals are in, having to instantly analyze battles, do you have any impressions that you'd want to share about the significance of the battle yesterday at Kafji?
What I would say is it's not very significant. This is part of the problem of instant media news, that anything that happens at once is picked on and has to be analyzed. This was a minor skirmish. And I think that we'll probably see a lot more of them.
The Iraqi tanks crossed the Saudi Arabian border yesterday with their turrets turned, and that's a sign of surrender. And apparently when the Saudis came to accept the surrender, the Iraqis turned the turrets back around and started firing.
Well, you tell me it's a sign of surrender. I had never heard that in my life before.
Really? This is what I've been reading.
That is what I've been reading, and it is completely news to me. It was never regarded as such in Europe, so far as I know. Signs of surrender are absolutely clear. It is showing of white flags. If a convention has grown up somewhere that you turn your guns around to show that you're surrendering, it is not widely known.
So why do you think we're hearing this?
I think that there is always a tendency, A, to demonize the enemy and say he's cheating. And one's always got to be aware of that. And B, to give some explanation of why they did so well. One always tends to say, when one is defeated, unfair. They hit below the belt. They shouldn't have done it. They're nasty people. So I think immediately it would seize people trying to explain why the Saudis ran away, would say, they were deceived by the Iraqis. I don't buy that one for a single moment.
Are you having lively debates in your classes now? I wonder how your classes are being affected by the war.
I very firmly in my classes make them stick to what they're supposed to learn, but we're having lively debates outside.
Sir Michael Howard is a professor of military and naval history at Yale University.